Well, good afternoon. Thank you for taking time this afternoon to join us in this seminar and workshop. What I would like to do is take about 45 minutes, maybe an hour, to present some material that I've been working on. Some of this material, not all of it, some of this material is found in my Many Colors book if you wanted to follow up and read some of the background information on this topic. Many Colors is available in the bookstore, and that would be where a lot of the introduction to this material would be coming in from. And the other part of the material comes from an article that I wrote for Sage Leadership Journal, which talks about new ways of doing leadership because of the way that the culture has changed. So that, unfortunately, is not available, easily accessible. It's one article in a book of like 100 articles, and the book is like $150. So you probably don't want to buy that book. But Money Colors is a lot cheaper. It's much less than that, and that's available in the bookstore. So what I want to do is give us a little bit of background on the topic of cultural intelligence. What does it mean to engage each other in a cross-cultural way, and what are some tools that we could use to encourage and engage in this cross-cultural dialogue? As I said last night in the plenary session, we're dealing with some extraordinary changes in our culture, and you know this in Vancouver, how much the city has changed and how diverse the city has become. And you also are very much aware of that when we talk about missions, one of the most important things we talk about is cross-cultural ministry. We are crossing cultures. We are dealing with different cultures. So it's very important for us when we start talking about missions and ministry in this very rapidly changing world, and especially in changing cities, it's very important for us to understand what are the tools and gifts and abilities that we might need to help us be more effective in this cross-cultural ministry. What I'm going to do is I'm going to set up why it's been so difficult to do cross-cultural ministry. Oftentimes when I talk in my class and to my students, one of the first things I lay out is we have to understand how we got to where we are. Why is it that the world is the way it is? Why is it that our society is the way it is? Why is it so hard to have cross-cultural relationships? Why is it so hard to have cross-cultural connections? And so we're going to set the stage in the first 10 minutes, and I'm going to outline for you some things that are actually research done in the U.S. And so I understand it doesn't always translate over into the Canadian context, but I'm asking you to kind of bear with me in the first 10 minutes as I explain to you what happened in the U.S. and how it created the inability in the churches in the U.S. to engage in cross-cultural ministry and in cross-cultural, or what I call cultural intelligence. So let's begin with a quick analysis of the way the church in the United States has become highly, highly segregated. So the first category that are up there is that in the sociological definition of diversity, if you want to talk about the sociological definition of multi-ethnicity, if you have 80% of one group and 20% of another group, technically that's a multi-ethnic group by sociological definitions. Now to me, that seems like very generous categories, but 80% of one group, 20% of another, you officially qualify as a multi-ethnic organization, institution, etc. Now even using those extremely generous guidelines, what we have found is that the churches in the United States are highly, highly segregated. The last count was that only about 7% of the churches would qualify as multi-ethnic, even though we use these very generous guidelines of 80% of one group and 20% of another group. So even using generous guidelines, you have a very low number of integrated churches or multi-ethnic churches. The second bullet item there is that there was a study done by Michael Emerson, who's a sociologist at Rice University, and he was trying to figure out, are churches segregated because neighborhoods are segregated? Now, are you following? So he was asking the question because people say, well, why is your church segregated? And the answer usually is, well, our neighborhood is one ethnicity and race, and therefore it would mean that our churches would be one ethnicity and race. And so in the U.S., he looked at neighborhood schools and compared them to neighborhood churches. And you see there this index, the number for average public schools, the diversity number is 0.48, so it's kind of right in the middle. The average diversity for congregation is 0.08. I'm not going to go into the explanation of how he came to these numbers, but essentially is saying that schools, public schools, local schools are six times more diverse than the local church. So you can see, you can just think about those numbers. Congregational diversity is extremely low, 0.08. average public school is right about the middle, 0.48. So the average public school, which usually reflects the neighborhood, is six times more diverse than the average church, which does not reflect the neighborhood. So the schools do a better job of reflecting the neighborhood. They're fairly diverse. Churches in those same areas have a very different level of diversity. In fact, very little diversity. So what we're seeing then is that even though our neighborhoods are becoming diverse, our churches are not becoming diverse. So oftentimes when you deal with kids, the children in our community know about diversity already because they go to school with children of very different ethnicities. And it's normal for them to talk about a kid with a different sounding last name or different sounding first name. But if they go to church, it's all in all likelihood they're going to be with kids that are of the same ethnicity and race. The third bullet item here is another way of distinguishing, trying to measure the level of diversity. And Michael Emerson looked at the most segregated U.S. cities. Which cities had the highest level of segregation? So he looked at some major cities like Chicago, Detroit, Milwaukee, many of these urban centers in Chicago, like Chicago and Detroit, they have high levels of segregation, like extreme levels of segregation. So he added up all these numbers for the most extremely segregated cities and created an index that says that the most segregated cities in the U.S., about 10 of them, their average number of segregation is 0.6. So the higher the number, the worse the segregation, the worse it is in terms of having people differently. So this is kind of opposite of what the previous was. So you have 0.6, which means that you have a really high level of segregation in the most segregated U.S. cities. Now, he did the same metric and applied it to American churches, U.S. churches, and found that U.S. churches had a segregation index of 0.91. That is extraordinarily high. It's higher than the 10 most segregated cities in the United States. The average American church, U.S. church, has a segregation rate of 0.91 compared to 0.6. So the cities, the most segregated cities, are better integrated than your typical American church, typical U.S. church. And so what he was looking at then is, when else did we see 0.91 as a segregation index? When else in history have we seen it that high? He found that only one other time in U.S. history. It was during the Jim Crow laws in the Deep South in the United States. Some of the worst examples of segregation you could ever imagine. The whole civil rights movement arose to fight this extreme level of local governments enacting segregation. That's when you had separate drinking fountains and separate schools and everything was separated. He said the only other time in U.S. history where you have this hyper-segregation that you see in the typical U.S. church was in these during the time of the Jim Crow laws in the Deep South. Now, again, I don't have comparable numbers to Canada, but you might have your own stories about how you've seen this come about, that our neighborhoods are diversifying, but our churches are not. We're seeing high levels of segregation. Even though there aren't laws that says our churches should be segregated, we find that most of our churches have high levels of segregation, and that we have kind of this rule that churches are going to be more segregated than society itself. So we're failing as a church, in other words, to live up to the standards that the Bible teaches us. And in fact, we're doing worse than the world. The world's doing better than us when it comes to something as important as all the nations gathering together to worship. So we have a hyper-segregation in contrast to actually what's happening in the world around us. Let's go to the next slide. So why is that the case? Why is it the churches have this hyper-segregation? And there are a couple of sociological terms I want to teach you. The first is called homophily. And it's a very simple concept. It was actually originally a Greek philosophy, and then it became a kind of a standardized Western sociological concept. It's called birds of a feather flock together. And if you scroll down, you'll see some of these kind of sociological speak. You don't need to understand exactly what it says. But what it comes down to is that we hang out with people that are like us. Usually that it's based upon education levels, and that's also based upon interest levels. It's oftentimes very much based on class, and oftentimes very much based on race or ethnic or national categories. So when you talk about birds of a feather flock together, we work with people in a particular work group. So you work with, if you're an engineer, you work with other engineers. And these engineers in all probability have the same level of education kitchen that you do. And so that when you have a barbecue on weekends, you invite the engineers from your firm to come and have a barbecue with you. So now you have your work friends and your weekend friends are also probably going to be the same group as your work friends. And it translates that your work friends, your weekend friends, and your evening friends are going to be the same group of friends you have at church, because birds of a feather flock together. So you end up with churches where everybody looks the same, whether that is physically or even or racially. It can also be economically, education level. So that's kind of another thing. Class is oftentimes a greater, a more important variable for churches, more so than race these days, because people who are the same class tend to cluster together. So again, homophily, birds of a feather flock together. The next concept is something called isomorphism. And this is a sociological concept that was very well explained by Stephen Warner. Stephen Warner is a sociologist at the University of Illinois in Chicago. And Dr. Warner says that if you have a closed system and you interact within that closed system, you will eventually adapt the norms within that system. And that's why homophily became the norm in U.S. churches, because it was seen as an effective way of doing church. Other churches within that system began to copy it, and now you have churches with hypersegregation. Are you following? So if you have a closed system, people follow and mimic each other, especially if something is working. Three examples of this. The first example of this is an example that Stephen Warner gives. Dr. Warner visits a congregation on the northern suburbs of Chicago. He visits this congregation. And he walks in, and it looks very much like what we have here. There are chairs set up, and there's instruments in the front, and there's a person up in the front giving a sermon homily. They open a book, and there is songs that they sing, and verse, and there are four different verses, and there's music in those hymns, and then there's an offering plate that goes around, and then there's a closing prayer that's offered by by the person who preached. And Warner says that I walked in there and it looked like a typical church. It's what you would describe as a typical North American church service. You have worship, you have a sermon, you have an offering, you have a closing prayer, all the basic things you would identify with a church. The problem is, it was not a church. It was a Buddhist temple. Now, what had happened is that this Buddhist community in the suburbs of Chicago, through the process of what we call isomorphism, had adapted patterns of behavior that is normative for American churches. Right? It's normal to have a song that you read out of a book, and you have these verses and the music in the book. It's normal for the leader of that group to come up and say a homily or sermon. It's normal to collect the offering during the service. And so through the process of isomorphism, this Buddhist congregation had essentially adapted Christian practices, but only in form. They were doing Buddhist words through these hymns. The sermon was a Buddhist sermon rather than a Christian sermon, but the process of isomorphism had created this adaptive process within that system of religion in Chicago. There's another example of this that I think is quite comical, and this is, again, another example in Chicago. There is a Buddhist monk community in the inner city of Chicago. And all the monks within this community have taken a vow of poverty. And these are the religious leaders of that community. They've all taken a vow of poverty. But they all have retirement plans, like pretty large retirement plans. So it's really bizarre to think that these people who have taken a vow of poverty, we're going to be poor for the rest of our lives. When they retire, they might have $1 million to spend, because they have these huge retirement plans. So why do they have retirement plans when they have taken a vow of poverty? Because of isomorphism. Within a closed system, in many cases, American clergy receive some kind of retirement plan. So we're going to give a retirement plan to monks who've taken a vow of poverty. Isomorphism. Here's another example. About 2 years ago, I was, as some of you know, I transitioned from being a pastor to being a professor, and I really miss preaching at local churches. I do more of these kinds of things, workshops and conferences, so I don't get to preach at local churches as much. So I prayed to the Lord one spring, actually, Lord, I really want to preach at local churches. And that summer, that following summer, I got about 10 invitations to about 10 different churches all over the United States, all over the U.S. I was in Seattle, I was in California, I was in Texas, I was in Chicago, I was in Maryland, I was in Boston, I was in Florida, I was in Atlanta, like 10 different cities all over the U.S. And I visited all these churches and I spoke at all of these churches. Most of them were kind of young, hip, evangelical churches in major urban centers. And I noticed something after about the third week of preaching at these churches. Every single church had the exact same item of furniture for the pastor to use. It actually wasn't the music stand. It definitely was not the podium that you typically have in churches. What did these hip young evangelical churches use for the pastor to preach from? It's actually right next to me. The round cafe table. Every single one of them had the round cafe table, counter height, and then, yep, there it is, the stool that comes up right next to the cafe table. Every single one of these churches had that. That's isomorphism. And in fact, I began to ask them, where did you get this idea? Because every church is using this round cafe, counter height cafe table. And he said, we first saw it at a Willow Creek Leadership Conference, and we used it, and then another church saw us use it, and they used it, and then another church saw us use it, and they use it. This is isomorphism. Now, what happens with the process of isomorphism is that it is a non-theological process. You don't need theology to copy patterns of behavior from another church. And so this idea of homophily, birds of a feather flock together, and that it's better to do church with people like yourselves, which is not theologically rooted, that's a very pragmatic idea. We should hang out with people that are like ourselves, and we do better as a church if we just have people that look like us and think like us. That's not a theological concept. That's not biblical. That's actually a sociological concept, which through the process of isomorphism became the norm for all the churches in the United States. So that it became normal. It became normalized. It became, this is the way we always do things. We always have churches that are divided because birds of a feather flock together. And if we want to grow churches, and if we want to have big churches, then the best way to do that is to have birds of a feather that flock together. And so the process of isomorphism has created this larger sense of acceptance of the homophily principle. Let's go to the next slide. Now, this raises some interesting questions, though, when we start talking about the beginning of cross-cultural relationships. So the reality of single ethnic, homogenous uniprincipal, segregated churches has been the norm for many, many years, for a long, long time. But especially from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it actually became a church strategy, a church planning, church growth strategy to have homogenous uniprincipals, homophily systems. But what happened, though, is that in this process, as we are now shifting from homophily to, hey, let's have more heterogeneity. Let's have more diversity. Let's not just have churches that are all Chinese and all Anglo-Canadian or all Middle Eastern. Let's have more integrated churches and diverse churches. The problem has been that we have built a system that seems to work in isolation and in ethnic specificity, that's much harder to translate when you start getting ethnic diversity. Well, let me explain that a little more clearly. The foundation of this is something called social capital. How many of you have read a book called Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam? He's a Harvard professor, government, political science professor. Wrote a landmark book a couple of decades ago now, but it's called Bowling Alone. And he was measuring in the U.S. civic engagement. And he looked at kind of major markers of civic engagement. And he looked at things like voting patterns, how many people are voting. And he noticed that over the last several decades, voting is going like this. Less and less people are participating through voting. Less and less people are involved in civic government. Less and less people are involved in like civic organizations, the Rotaries, the Key Club, whatever civic organizations there are, their membership was going down. And actually, less and less people were going to church. There was less and less involvement within the community in the church as well. So he was looking at all these markers of civic involvement and found that there was less and less people connecting to one another. And he said the one marker that was right in the middle of all of these declining markers was the idea of bowling alone. So 40 years ago, when there was a stronger civic connection and people were more connected to each other, there were a lot more league bowlers. I don't know if you have league bowling in Canada, but about 30, 40 years ago in the U.S., this was a big thing. They all had these leagues. You formed a team of four, and you bowled against another league, and you wore these shirts with your name stitched on it, and you had your own ball and your own shoes, and you went to the bowling alley every Monday night with Hank and Larry and Frank, and you would bowl together, and then you would bowl against another team, and you bonded together. You had a friendship. You had a relationship. It was a small group in some sense, and it created social capital. But what happened, though, is that those groups start falling apart. Less and less people are in bowling leagues, and more people are, as Putnam puts it, bowling alone. So he talks about the very important value of social capital. That in order to build healthy churches, actually, as well as healthy civic society, and healthy relationships between people, you need this concept of social capital. But let me explain social capital a little bit more. Social capital is the idea that we are building a relationship with one another by not exchanging monetary capital, not money, but a social capital. We're exchanging social capital with one another. So I'll give you this example. So about 9 years ago, my family moved from the New England area of the United States to the Midwest. And I don't know if you heard, New England was hit with a very massive snowstorm about a week ago where the snow just kind of dumped on this city. And we New Englanders, when we lived in New England, I lived there for 15 years, we are hardy people. When a big snowstorm comes like that, 2 feet of snow, we know what to do, and we hunker down, and we dig deep, and that's why we're going to win the Super Bowl on Sunday. We dig deep, and we fight, and we do everything we can. And one of the things is that we don't believe in those machines that clear the snow. That's for wimpy people. You know, you don't have a machine to clear snow. You use a shovel. You're a strong New Englander. You use a shovel. Maybe even your hands. Whatever you need to do, you're going to clear that snow without a machine happening. So I'm a New Englander. I'm a hardy New Englander. I shoveled my snow with a snow shovel. And then we moved to Chicago about 9 years ago, and I looked at all my wimpy neighbors with their snow blowers. What is wrong with these people with their snow blowers? Why do you need a machine to clear the snow? I've got my shovel. That lasted about 2 months. And it lasted about 2 months because in November, I was asked to speak at a conference in Southern California. So it's 72 degrees. It's wonderful. I'm in my shorts in this conference. And I get a phone call from my wife the second day of the conference in the morning. And she asked me, why do we not have a snowblower? Why do we have this beat up old shovel? And I said, well, we're hardy New Englanders. We don't believe in snowblowers. These wimpy Midwest. No, you are in California right now with 72 degree weather and there's a half a foot of snow on the ground. And so why is it that we don't have a snowblower? So what happens? My neighbor, Brian Morehouse, he's a lifelong Midwesterner and he's a lot smarter man than I am. And so he knows that these newcomers to Chicago need some help. So he actually gets his snowblower and he clears my sidewalk and he clears my driveway. And so now my wife is not as angry with me as she was a few minutes ago. What has he done? Well, first of all, he saved my marriage. But second of all, he has built social capital with me. I'm not going to give him money. It's not that kind of capital. But if he ever needs a ride to the airport, oh yeah, I'm going to give him a ride to the airport. And when Brian had a cancer scare a few years ago, we were there to say, hey, is there anything we can do? Because we were trying to build, or we were naturally building this social capital with one another. It's a very important part of bonding relationships. And of course, you think about this in the church. Happens all the time in the church, right? A member of your church is sick. The whole church gets together and says, okay, you bring a casserole tomorrow, and you bring some food the next day. And in fact, my wife was sick about 5 years ago. She had pneumonia. And the whole seminary, my whole seminary community, students and other faculty, they made a rotation, and they brought casseroles and soups and food so that my wife wouldn't have to cook and I wouldn't have to worry about cooking for the family. And so that, what does that do? It builds a wonderful social capital, and it's an important part of church life to have social capital. Now, I raise this because Putnam, in his initial research, says we need more social capital. And one of his follow-up research projects, which actually I think he never published because it turned out to be too controversial, in his follow-up project, he hinted that social capital does not work as well in multicultural environments. Now, follow me here. Social capital works wonderfully in a single ethnic environment, but when you start getting multicultural environments, it's actually harder to pull off. Mainly because there's certain currency in certain cultures that does not play in other cultures. There are certain things that you do to build social capital in one culture that is not necessarily social capital in another culture. That's when you have cultural insensitivity, right? So you know that this is a good thing to do in my culture, but it might not be a good thing to do in another culture. So a really bizarre example of this. In Korean culture in the U.S., and actually in Korea as well, when someone moves into a new house and you visit them for the first time, I don't know how many Koreans are in here, you're supposed to bring a huge box of laundry detergent. I don't know where that came from. I don't know where it started, but I was told if you go to somebody's house that has just moved into a new house, bring a big box of laundry detergent. That's what I was taught, and that's what I do every time you go to a new house. And I did this in my multi-ethnic church. And so I bring my big box of laundry, and they're like, what are you doing? Why are you bringing laundry detergent into my house? And they're actually insulted. Are you implying that my clothes are not clean? Why are you bringing laundry detergent to me? Because social capital in the Korean community, you build it by bringing laundry detergent into the house, but certainly not in other communities. That's not the thing to do. So social capital that seems to work in one context doesn't always translate into the other into a different context. And that's when we start thinking about the concept that I want to introduce to you about how we do multicultural ministry. It's the concept of brokerage. And so if we go to the next slide, I'll explain how brokerage works. Brokerage works, actually the next slide, there's a graph there. Brokerage is based upon some sociological study called cluster analysis. A lot of this work was done by Professor Ronald Burt, who was actually my professor when I was an undergrad, and he taught at Columbia University for many years and realized what many academics realize after a while, you really can't make money being an academic. So he leaves Columbia University as a professor and he starts working for Wall Street. And what he does for Wall Street is about the time when all these companies are going global and multinational. And they realize that they want to have leaders and executives who understand cross-cultural communication, right? Because we're in a global economy, you've got to have cultural competency, cultural intelligence in order to be an effective global leader in the economy. You need multicultural people. So they were asking the question, how can we do this? And so Ronald Burt did this cluster analysis. He did a cluster analysis of how people interact within a business. And he found that there are clusters that form. And I mentioned this earlier. People kind of hang out with people that have a similar job than they do or similar class. And again, sometimes similar race. And so what you end up with, the engineers kind of eat lunch together. And the executives eat lunch together. And the custodial staff eat lunch together. And the factory workers eat lunch together, and then they also have barbecues where they invite just that group. And so you end up in any kind of company, in Wall Street or any kind of factory, you end up with these clusters. So when you typically think about social capital and how you raise up the best leaders, so the best leaders, actually, anybody have a pointer? Is there a pointer there? Well, let's go back to that previous slide. I want you to think about these clusters. So when you think about these clusters and you think about social capital, usually what you think about in terms of leadership is you think that the best leaders come from the middle of the cluster. Because they're in the center of everything, right? So you think, okay, who are the best leaders? Well, it's the leader who has friendships everywhere, who's built social capital with everybody in his or her clusters. So intuitively, the first reaction of our best multicultural leaders are going to be those in the middle of each cluster. Turns out, that's wrong. The best leaders are not those in the middle of the cluster. In fact, the best leaders are where? They're in the margins. They're on the margins of their cluster. And not just on the margins of the cluster, they are comfortable in all of the clusters. In fact, what they do is they move back and forth from one cluster to the other. And in the process of moving from cluster to cluster, they actually become some of the most innovative and thoughtful leaders, because they're not in one cultural group, they're in multicultural groups. And they do what's called brokerage. They broker ideas and they broker relationships between the clusters, and that actually makes for the best leaders. So I'll give you an example of this. I grew up in a Korean immigrant church, and those of you, and especially in the U.S., in the Korean American church and the immigrant church in the U.S., there's a particular way things are done. And also, especially in youth ministry, and I was a youth member growing up in high school ministry, there was actually like five speakers, Korean speakers, who spoke at every Korean church retreat in the U.S. at one point. I can name them because they came through the church, they take turns, and they would go through every church. And so there's a cluster of these speakers that come from the Korean community. And at almost every typical Korean retreat during that time, there were about 20 songs that all the churches sang. It was only, you know, there was a certain set. And if you didn't sing those songs, people were upset. We didn't sing, you know, this song, this retreat. It wasn't a good retreat because we didn't sing that song. So there was a particular culture that developed around Korean immigrant churches and especially youth ministry. And they would have conferences and retreats and ways of doing things that were, again, process of isomorphism. You develop these particular clusters and you develop certain patterns within that cluster. So that's what I grew up in. Those are the ideas that I was formed in. I had a particular pattern of behavior that I learned from that cluster. Then I went away to college. I went to college in New York, and my Christian world began to broaden quite a bit. It was the first time I went to an African-American church when I was a freshman in college. I got involved not with the Korean church, but I got involved with my InterVarsity Fellowship, which was much more diverse. And I met Christians from all over the U.S., but Christians from all different races, ethnicities, and cultures. And then I went to a chapter camp, and I went to a Bible conference, and I started going to all these different things that were very different from my youth group experience in the Korean immigrant church. And I started seeing, hey, the black church does things in a very different way. Hey, you know, the InterVarsity does things in a very different way. So after my freshman year, I go back to my home church, and they ask me, hey, could you help us plan the upcoming summer retreat? I say, sure, I'll be happy to do that. I did that last year. I'll be happy to help plan for this upcoming year. And I go into that room, and I start getting all these brilliant ideas. Why? Because I saw something I saw in the black church. I saw something in the university. And I come to them and say, hey, guys, why don't we try this instead? And I don't tell them, well, I just saw them do this at chapter camp a week ago at InterVarsity. They say, that's a great idea. That's a brilliant idea. Where did you get that idea? Well, the Holy Spirit has given me and imparted knowledge upon me that I'm able to share with you. But where did it come from? I was at a different cultural setting, and I'm brokering an idea that I learned in a different cultural setting, and I'm bringing it back. And then when it times for a guest speaker, I say, oh yeah, it's so-and-so's turn to come and speak. It's his fifth year now. So, you know, I met this great speaker in New York. She's a dynamic preacher, preaches the word of God. Why don't we try to bring her in instead? And we bring her in, and everybody loves her. She brings all this fresh insight into the church. And I'm brokering ideas and relationships. So the most powerful and effective and innovative leaders are not at the center of the cluster. They're actually at the margins of the clusters. They're actually moving between cluster and cluster and group to group. And they're brokering ideas, relationships, and thoughts between these clusters. This is very helpful for us because it challenges us to think about the world that we live in, and that maybe innovative leadership is not just being in one place, but actually being in multiple settings simultaneously. This draws from the work first of an African-American sociologist by the name of W.E.B. Du Bois. And Du Bois says that African-Americans have something called double consciousness. And it is the thought process that says that an African American in the majority culture world has to act a certain way, talk a certain way, think a certain way, eat certain foods, dress a certain way in order to fit into the majority culture. But then that's one consciousness. There's a second consciousness where the African American moves back into the black church, the black neighborhood, the black community, and acts a different way, speaks a different way. The food is different. The interaction is different. And so Du Bois points out that you develop this double consciousness, the ability to live between two very different worlds. Now, Du Bois looked at that as a burden. That's a very much a burden that African Americans have to carry. And I would agree with that, that it is seen as a burden. There's a Latino theologian by the name of, actually two of them, that have kind of brought this concept into a different light. Virgilio Elizondo, who teaches at Notre Dame, and Eldon Villafane, who teaches at Gordon-Conwell. And Villafane was one of my mentors, and Eldon used to talk about this idea of triple consciousness. So double consciousness is when an African-American is in the black church, the black neighborhood, and then has to go work in the white world and develops this dual identity. And then he says, second-generation Latinos have a triple consciousness. Three identities. The first identity is the same with the black community. You go out into the majority white world, you act a certain way, you dress a certain way, you talk a certain way, you eat certain foods in order to fit in. But then you go to your parents' culture. And that is another culture that you're familiar with, but it's not quite you. So yes, you appreciate the cuisine of the group, rice and beans, that's the kind of food you like. You appreciate Spanish, but you don't speak it as well. You appreciate the services that are done in that first generation culture. But that's not quite your consciousness. That's two of them. Where the second generation English-speaking Latino feels the most at home is in the third consciousness, which is where? With other second-generation English-speaking Latinos. Now, to me, this was just revelatory as an Asian American to start thinking through my ethnic identity. Because there are many times that I go into a majority culture setting, and yeah, I know how to front. I know how to figure it out. I know the ways to interact with other people. I know the kind of foods that I'm going to eat. It's going to be a lot of potato salad and macaroni. I understand that. I understand that's what I'm going to have to do. I understand I'm going to have to dress a certain way, talk a certain way, pass myself off in a certain way. That's going to find that I'm going to fit into that culture, majority culture. And then I can go to a Korean-speaking congregation, an immigrant church. And yeah, I can figure it out as well, because that's the culture that I grew up in. It's the community that I understand. So, and maybe I don't speak Korean fluently, but I can pick up what's going on. And of course, I appreciate the food. I can eat kimchi and all these other things. Yes, I can appreciate that. But I'm not ultimately also completely at home in that culture. Where I feel myself the most comfortable is with other second-generation Asian Americans who have also the experience of feeling not quite at home in these two other worlds. And so we tend to bond together as second-generation English-speaking Asian Americans. This is the concept that Villafane and Elizondo calls triple consciousness. Now, Du Bois looked at double consciousness as a burden. I would look at it, and so would Elizondo and Villafane especially, would look at triple consciousness as actually a gift. In fact, it's very similar, but not quite, to the idea of third culture, where you have missionary kids whose parents are from kind of a host from another culture, maybe in the U.S., Canada, or in Europe, and then they go as missionaries to another culture. And so the children of missionaries learn the culture of their parents, which is Western culture, but then they might be living in Bangladesh, they might be living in Kenya, and so they're picking up the Kenyan and Bangladeshi culture. And then so they develop this third culture, and then they start connecting with each other. So in fact, at some point, it doesn't even matter whether you grew up in Bangladesh or Kenya or Colombia. You actually have a third culture that experience of that, actually, you can still relate. Even if you grew up in Africa, Asia, or Latin America, that third culture experience actually creates a point of connection. So this idea of triple consciousness, which actually, that language I prefer to third culture. I can get into that another time, but I think triple consciousness is actually a better language semantically for that. But this idea is that because you've been in multicultural settings, brokerage, you know how now to learn to be in also other multicultural settings. And it's what I mentioned last night, that it is so important, if we're talking about multicultural ministry, that the experience of crossing culture is so much more valuable than simply reading about another culture. It's like any travel that you've done. My family, we love to travel during the summers. One of the best things about being a professor is to have the summers off with the kids. And so we try to go to as many different places. We come to Vancouver. We go to Hawaii. We go to Athens. We went to Australia. I'm planning to take the kids to Korea next year. And we're planning to go to South Africa in the next couple of years. And there's a huge difference, though, as for those of you who like to travel, between reading a guidebook about that country and actually going to that country itself, right? You know that, you know, sometimes they'll describe a restaurant in a guidebook that looks nothing like what you imagine, and then you get there and you realize it's a very different thing. So there's a huge difference between reading about a culture versus actually experiencing a culture. That again goes to the idea of triple consciousness. Are we experiencing another culture, living into that other culture, and that's how our triple consciousness is being shaped. So actually, if you can skip a slide, let's go to this next slide, the one after this. I want to talk about how we understand the cultural dynamic. And this is in my book, Many Colors. And I talk about the kind of the spectrum of culture. So on one end, you have, for example, individual orientation. And then on the other hand, you have group orientation. And that many of us kind of fall on the spectrum at some point. Now, very generally speaking, Western culture tends to be very individualistic oriented. And Eastern culture tends to be very group oriented. So an example of this is I was at a multicultural church and the worship team was getting together. And the Caucasians in the group were like, okay, you know, it's 7:30. We said we're going to start at 7:30, so we're going to start at 7:30. And I know Jack is late again. But, you know, we can't wait for Jack. You know, he's just one guy. He'll catch up. But we really have to get this task done. And the Asians in the group were saying, oh no, Jack is too important to the group. We can't not have Jack here before the worship starts. You know, I know he's an individual, but it's the whole group that has to practice together, so we have to wait. And so you see the difference between an individual orientation, which says, okay, he'll figure it out, he'll catch up, versus the group orientation is, well, we can't. We have to wait for the whole group to be here. I noticed this. And I don't know if this happens in Canada, but when you have a group of Asians together after like a service and you're hanging out, it takes forever to make a decision. Y'all know what I'm talking about, right? Asians in this room, it just takes forever. And so after church is done, you see this group of Asians in a circle. Oh, where do you want to go today? Oh, let's go here. No, I don't like that place. Okay, so let's go here. And it takes like an hour to decide where to go eat because it has to be a group decision. It can't be just one individual saying, I like this food, we're going to go there. It has to be a group decision. So everybody kind of stands around for an hour. Just kind of stepping on their feet, and then after an hour, somebody finally makes a group decision, and it has to be a group because of the group orientation versus the individual orientation. Another category, direct communication versus indirect communication. Some of that is just physical. Direct communication, you look someone in the eye. Indirect communication, you avert your glance down. And again, this is kind of Western culture and Eastern culture as well. In fact, this created a bit of controversy in the U.S. in urban centers, where many of the shopkeepers in urban centers and inner city neighborhoods were actually Korean shopkeepers. So they ran the grocery stores, the vegetable stands, and the carry-out business, the small sub shops. And the African Americans were more direct communication, would come in and look them in the eye and speak directly to them. And in Asian culture, if someone looks at you, you look down. And so the African Americans interpreted this glancing down as an insult. So why can't you look me in the eye? What, I'm not good enough for you? Don't look at me like that. Why are you looking at me like that? And he's saying, no, I'm just, you know, trying to be respectful, because in Asian culture, you can't look someone in the eye because that's disrespectful. Whereas in the African American culture, not looking at someone in the eye is disrespectful. So you have this clash of culture of direct and indirect communication. Some of that is physical space. One of my friends, he's a Chinese American pastor in the LA area. And he was talking about, he was at a board meeting and he was in a room very much like this. And he was talking to a Caucasian who was more direct communication. And he was what they call a close talker. And so he would kind of lean in close to very directly talk very close and directly to him. And of course, as an indirect communicator, he would back away, right? So this whole thing became the Caucasian guy would lean in to get close and he would back away. And so he said if there was a camera in that up there with like stop motion photography, it would look like he was being chased around the room, because he would take a step forward to get closer, take a step back, and it would be like running around the room, and for about half an hour, they're chasing each other. So that's the difference between direct communication and indirect communication. equality and hierarchy. This is an interesting contrast for me. I serve on a number of national boards, and it's really interesting because as an Asian, I naturally just kind of within my upbringing tend towards hierarchy. Now, I'm not putting a value judgment on this, and I'm not talking kind of in gender cases. I'm talking about there are certain communities, in Western community, you kind of assume equality. In many Asian cultures, you actually have more of a hierarchical system. It's more of a Confucian culture, and so you have more of a hierarchy. But here's the problem that I encountered. As someone who comes from hierarchy, when I walk into a room where everybody assumes equality, I actually am at a disadvantage, and I'm not equal. Does that make sense? So I go into a room, there's equality in the room, or it's assumed there's equality, but because I have the mindset of hierarchy, I'm actually at a disadvantage. I'll give you an example of this. So I'm on the board of World Vision in the U.S., and I was really intimidated because the board members are just these evangelical giants, including Leighton Ford, a Canadian actually, who moved to the U.S. and is just, you know, brother-in-law of Billy Graham, and just a wonderful, ironic, just a deep spiritual leader within the evangelical movement. So it was one of the reasons I wanted to join the board, to get to hang out with folks like Leighton Ford. And so I just walked into that room kind of intimidated by these giants of evangelical Christianity, these people that have been serving the Lord faithfully. They're in their 70s. Leith Anderson is on our board. And so these are like people you have these extreme high respect for. Jerry White, president of Navigators. And so, as a relatively young Asian American, when Leighton Ford speaks, you listen, right? I mean, you know, when a man of his stature, Billy Graham's brother-in-law, when he speaks, after he speaks, as an Asian, I'm going to stop and just nod my head for about 5 minutes. Let him know, oh, I absolutely, you're an elder. I agree with you. And I'm not going to speak because I can't cut off Leighton Ford. And I can't speak right away because that's rude. So I need to wait for about a minute to acknowledge Leighton Ford has spoken. I'm just going to acknowledge that. Now, my first meeting, that's what I was planning to do. I got Leighton Ford, Leith Anderson. I'm going to be respectful and hierarchical and nod my head respectfully when an elder speaks. But then, there's this moment where Leighton Ford is speaking, 75-year-old elder statesman of evangelicalism, and this 29-year-old member of the board jumps in and cuts him off. And I almost jumped out of my seat and choked this guy because I'm thinking, you just cut off Billy Graham's brother-in-law. What are you doing? But there was this incredible idea that there is an equality and that you could actually, and white folks, you're really good at this. When somebody's just about finishing up, you know, just the right time to jump in. It's like seamless. It's amazing how you do this. So the person is just about feeling, and then somebody jumps in at that right moment. I'm too hierarchical. I'm waiting for the pause and the nodding of the heads. So I always miss my opportunity to speak because somebody is always kind of speaking over each other because there's an assumption of equality. And with that assumption of equality, you actually created a de facto hierarchy for someone who's coming in with the idea of hierarchy. So this was another illustration of this. Is a good friend of mine who in second grade, he's a Japanese American, said that he got straight A's. And then he moved to a new class with a new teacher in third grade, and he started getting B's and C's. And the B's and C's were not based upon his schoolwork, it was based upon class participation. And he was getting low grades in class participation. And they were trying to figure out what happened. Well, it turns out in second grade, the teacher would call on the kids, invite them to contribute, would say, why don't you answer this question? And everybody would participate equally because he was calling on the kids. It's a hierarchy. The teacher controls the flow of the conversation. In third grade, the teacher was more equality and said, all right, anybody, raise your hands and say whatever you want to say. And so now you have this equality. But as a Japanese American, he couldn't fit in there because there's a Japanese proverb that says the nail that sticks out gets hammered down. So he doesn't want to get hammered down, so he's not going to raise his hand. So he gets these low grades in this participation because he's assuming that hierarchy is the way to go, but the classroom environment was one of equality. Task-oriented versus relationship-oriented. Most of you kind of figured that out. Again, it goes back to let's finish the task that we have to do. Versus, no, I think it's more important that we pray. It's more important that we, you know, share what's going on. No, that takes too long. It's going to take. We only have 2 hours to meet, and if we spend an hour and a half praying, then we're not going to get anything done. And then the person, well, no, actually, getting to know each other is getting something done. And so there's that miscommunication between task versus relationship-oriented. to. Low context and high context. It's actually cut off at the bottom. But the very bottom one is shame versus guilt. And this is an important one because Western culture generally is a guilt-oriented culture, and Eastern culture tends to be shame-oriented culture. And these are generalizations I understand, but what I'm trying to point out is that guilt tends to be very individualistic. You feel guilty about something you've done as an individual, whereas shame is much more community-oriented. And you feel not only the guilt of what you've done, but how it impacts your family. That's a very different dynamic of how one deals, for example, with sin. So sin, in the individual context, you say, I feel guilty about a sin I committed. I want to make sure I do the right thing now. Whereas in Asian culture, I not just feel guilty about what I've done, I feel terrible that it has brought shame to my family. You see the difference there. If an individual commits a bad thing, then you feel bad about it for yourself. In shame-based culture, you feel bad about how it has impacted negatively your family's identity, the shame that it has brought. So now when you start talking about the language of guilt and shame and sin, there are different ways that people are accessing the concept of sin. So one example of this is, and this is not always the case, but in my evangelism efforts, especially with Buddhists, but also with non-Christian Asians, who are kind of atheistic Asians, who are more kind of steeped in Asian culture. When you start talking about how the older brother was beaten up for the sins of the younger brother by the father, the Asian says, what? That's terrible. Why would I follow a father like that? Are you following what I'm saying? That sometimes you talk about this narrative of the older brother, Jesus, was beaten up by the father because of the sins of the younger brother. Now, if we couch it in kind of U.S. Western terms, that actually makes sense. There's this individual guilt that was taken away by somebody else. That makes sense. But in shame-based culture, does that actually release you of shame? It actually increases your shame. That you couldn't handle this yourself. Somebody else had to do this for you. And not only did somebody else have to do this for you, it was your older brother who took the punishment. And so now you don't feel any better. You feel worse. Now, how then do you begin to communicate the gospel between a guilt-based culture and a shame-based culture? So these are the questions we need to start asking when we talk about cross-cultural ministry. And what I would say is that when we talk about cross-cultural ministry, usually what we do, and especially in multi-ethnic churches, is we decide we're an individual-oriented church. And if you want to be a part of our church, you're going to either have to adapt or you're going to have to go somewhere else. Or we're an indirect communication church, and so you're going to have to adapt, or you might have to go somewhere else. So even if we don't do this racially or ethnically, culturally, we set up particular categories of how we do things, and if you don't fit, you either have to adjust, or you might have to go somewhere else. My challenge in cultural intelligence is not to pick a spot on the line and says, everybody at our church has to come here. We're, let's say, a 2 on the individual orientation scale. All of you have to come here. Or we're a 9 on the indirect scale, or a 9 on the hierarchy scale. Everybody has to come and adjust there. What we need to do is actually expand our capacity to not only deal with the 9s, but with the 10s and the 8s and the 7s. Now, you might not be able to deal with the 1s and the 2s, but you should be able to deal with more than just the 8s. You should be able to deal with 9, 10s. So you can expand, maybe not the whole spectrum, but you can certainly broaden the capacity within that spectrum. And that would be more inclusive in bringing people in across the cultures, rather than saying, this is who we are, you either fit or you don't. So the difference there for me is the difference between, in the U.S. we have, how do we deal with diversity? And this is my last point, we'll open up a question. The first method was something called the melting pot. Right? This is the melting pot idea. The U.S. is a melting pot. You bring all these different cultures together and you melt away their ethnic identity and you make them into cream of mushroom soup. That's what you do. You just melt it all away. And as one of my dear Native American friends used to say, we natives don't melt. You keep trying to melt us for 500 years. We're not melting, so stop trying to melt us. And so that idea has really been largely disregarded. Say, you really can't melt away a person's identity like that. So then you came up with something called the South salad bowl. This even sounds healthier, the salad bowl. So now you've got all these different vegetables in the salad bowl. So you don't just have iceberg lettuce and cherry tomatoes. You also have Napa cabbage, and you have kimchi, and you have jalapenos, and you have collard greens, and all these other vegetables start making the chickpeas, and all these other vegetables start making their appearance in the salad bowl. That's wonderful. You have all these different flavors. But what have we done with the salad bowl? We took the largest bucket of creamy ranch possible and just drenched the whole thing with creamy ranch. And so you put enough creamy ranch on kimchi, it stops tasting like kimchi, it starts tasting like creamy ranch. So you took away all the great flavors of kimchi and made this wonderful vegetable actually taste like creamy ranch. And that is oftentimes what passes for multi-ethnicity. Oh yeah, we like it that you look different. We like that we have different vegetables in the bowl, but at the end of the day, we're all going to look and taste the same. We're all going to act and taste the same. And that's not multi-ethnicity. That's actually cultural incompetence rather than competence. Let me pause there and see if there's kind of open it up for questions. I think we have about 15 more minutes before we have to break. 3 more minutes? Oh, wow. Okay. I thought we were ahead till 5:15 or 6:15. Well, okay, then let's ask 3 very quick questions. And actually, let me do this. We'll wrap up with 1 or 2 questions, and then if you want to stick around a little bit to kind of talk more in a smaller group, I don't think there's anything immediately after this. So we'll allow you to either stay. If you need to rush off, obviously go ahead. But if you want to stick around a little bit longer, I'll be happy to answer some more questions. But let's see if there's a question. Yeah. Yeah, so the Western culture wouldn't really care about that because the individual act of sin has been taken away. So it's more important that that's taken away than any kind of the shame-based activity. There was a question here. Yeah. And then we'll come back to the here. Again, our time is up, so if you want to go, that's fine. But if you want to stick around, I'll be more than happy to stick as long as we need to answer questions.
Is there a sharp contrast between the beginnings of the church in terms of their multi-ethnicity than there is today? This is just top of my head. Just looking at those models, has there been a huge change in it? And you've answered a lot of the why, so
yeah.
I'll leave that to you.
Yeah, well, so if you look at the long scope of church history, you had from the very beginnings of the church in Acts, extraordinary diversity, right? I mean, we talked about it a little bit yesterday with Acts chapter 15. That was part of the issues they were dealing with, this extreme diversity. I would argue that this some of it is just kind of nationalism, and when you have different countries and you end up in geographic different places, you're going to end up with lack of diversity. But the issue that I'm concerned about is that even when you have diversity in the society, you don't have it in the church. So that's more of a recent phenomenon, right? That's in the last 100 years or so in the U.S. and in Canada. We have greater diversity, and yet we don't have diversity in the church. Now, prior to that, you had the Syrian Orthodox Church, you had the Greek Orthodox Church. It was very much separated by these national and ethnic boundaries for a number of different reasons. But now you have much greater integration in our society, and yet we have the lack of diversity within our society, within our churches. Those are the things that I'm more concerned about right now. Yeah, question up here.
Homogeneous church, for that matter. I think one of the challenges is not that they don't necessarily want to become multi-ethnic per se, but one of the barrier would be like a language.
Yes.
So how would you...
Very important question. Now, there was a book written about 5-10 years ago, written by a friend of mine, Michael Emerson, and a number of others who are good friends of mine, and they wrote a book called United by Faith, and in it they said, whenever possible, all churches should be multi-ethnic. Now, what people saw was that second part and not the first part. So instead of saying whenever possible, they just jump to all churches should be multi-ethnic. And I would disagree with that assessment. I do not think all churches should be multi-ethnic, at least not at this point in North American history, mainly because of what you alluded to. There are a couple of reasons in the U.S. why there should be still some ethnic-specific churches. For example, in the history of the African-American church, a lot of the issues that created the African-American church in the first place, extreme racism, and even being kicked out of the church, of the white churches by of African Americans, that justifies for me the desire and the need for African American churches to continue. And then the fact that you mentioned race, and also tied into that certain cultural expressions, not race, language and certain cultural expressions. So I do think, especially with immigrant churches, we need to be aware we're not imposing, again, the hierarchy, we're not imposing a value system that privileges the dominant culture. Because by bringing in minorities in, you're not changing the church to accommodate, you're actually just bringing them in to fit into your culture. So that would be the problematic piece of it. So one of the ways I look at it is that with my mom, you know, I was a pastor of a multi-ethnic church. We did everything in English. We had a diverse congregation. My mom would come and visit us, and she would go to a Korean church before she would come to my church service. I was deeply offended. Mom, wait, I'm the pastor. Why do you have to go to another church before coming to my church service? He said, I don't understand half the stuff you say. She's saying this in Korean, of course. Yeah, you talk so fast anyway, and you speak in English, and I don't know what you're saying, so I just sit in the back and I pray for you and I read the Bible. And so for her, because of the language barrier, even for her son preaching, and she, again, would pray for me and be in the back, but she needed a church service in her Korean language and in her culture. And if we were to force her to go into a multi-ethnic setting, it would actually be very harmful, I think. And, you know, she, as I shared my story last night, she worked very hard to keep her family together. And the one time she had all week long where she felt safe and affirmed in her identity as a Korean woman was actually in the church. And why would I take that away from her? Because the rest of the time, she was a foreigner. She was a stranger. She was an outsider. The 6 days out of the week, she was the one person, she was the person who didn't speak English well. She was the person that didn't know the culture. She was a servant. So that one day a week, I don't want to take that away from her. And so I would argue that that's a very legitimate reason to have single ethnic. I think the issue is not, should there be single ethnic churches? My issue is more, should there be more multi-ethnic churches? Not reduce the number of single ethnic churches that have a legitimate reasons like language and culture, but increase the number of multi-ethnic churches that minister to a group that are capable and wanting to be in multi-ethnic churches. Yeah, one more question here. Yeah, last question.
Towards evangelism, not too long ago, a lot of missions switched from being location-based evangelism to being people group-based evangelism. So in a town where you have four tribal groups, you're only working with one specific tribal group.
Right.
And it has a lot of practical reasons behind it.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if you can speak to whether this form of evangelism and church planting hurts the witness of the church because it might not speak to the unity of the church.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if you can speak.
Great question. That's a great question, and I will admit to a Western bias in my teaching and reading, because I'm looking at American, Canadian, and European churches, and certainly the U.S. That are extraordinarily diverse in our society. And much more integrated in our society on a day-to-day level, right? I mean, there are laws that integrate us, school systems and all of works, there's much more integration. And so that's why I point to, given that multicultural, diverse reality, then the fact that we have so few multi-ethnic churches really seems like a disconnect between reality and what's happening in the church. But I am aware of, and so in fact, the Homogeneous Unit Principle started as a missionary movement, right? Donald McGavran looked at why are churches in India growing and other churches not growing, and he recognized because you're identifying people groups and ministering contextually to that people group. I would agree with that initial assessment of Donald McGavran. I think the problem became when it became codified as the only way to do things. It became the standardized isomorphism, standardized method by which we understand how ministry operates. And so do I think that, again, all on one side, all on the other? No, there's a lot of spectrum in between. I think in the U.S. and in Canada, you have a situation where because of diversity in society, it actually should perpetuate diversity in our churches as well. I think missionary issues, it might have to be just by case by case. So would you do this in South Africa, where you had this extreme segregation, or Rwanda? Rwanda, where you had this extreme segregation. So how would you bring, how would you recognize that reconciliation is an important part of the gospel message in both of these communities and not further the segregation, because that is antithetical to the gospel. But it could be in other communities where there's isolation and the community is very isolated, but then you have no choice but to be ethnic specific in those communities. Thank you so much for your time, and I appreciate all the work you put in today.